would you tell me the story of something hard that has happened to you?
I had a good friend who, for some reason, they wouldn't play with me, and that really hurt my feelings. And they kept, like, ignoring me and running away, and that was, like, really mean of them, and they wouldn't even tell me why, so it hurt my feelings.
I was riding a scooter, and then the scooter tripped over a pine cone, and I got scratched a lot. It hurt a lot, and my mom passed me, and I was just sitting on the grass crying. She was like, Elise, what's wrong? And like, it hurt, and it didn't, like, it didn't feel so great.
At school, somebody sits right next to me, and they keep on talking to me. I'm trying to listen to the teacher. A lot of times, people bully me at school and I'm trying to tell them to stop, but they don't.
Welcome to The Child in Our Midst, a podcast exploring the spiritual lives of kids. I'm Lindsay, and I'm the resource director at the Center for Faith and Children.
And I am Ahiwani, the managing director at the Center for Faith and Children. And today, we're going to be talking about what it means for the hard things children experience, it means, and their experiences in terms of expressing those things to God. And so, Lindsay, as we set up the conversation, why does this conversation matter to you as a parent?
There are two things that immediately come to mind. The first is, so I shared a little bit about my background, but I have five kids, right? And then in addition to that, I've spent my career kind of working either in schools or in children's ministry. And so I spent a good deal of my life around children, pretty much like since I was a child. And I think that at some point early on, as I was working with kids, it kind of hit me. The things that are hard for children are actually hard for them.
Yes.
As an adult, you know, we can kind of like look at, you know, a child's concern and kind of think like, oh, I remember when those were my concerns and I wish those were my concerns now. You know, I saw in myself this tendency to kind of be like, well, that's not really a big deal. And then I think it was probably the Lord who stopped me. I'm just kind of like, no, these are the places where children will meet me. And so I think as a parent, just to hold that in my mind, even in like the flow of day-to-day life, is something that I want to do. And then on the other side of that is, you know, I think I want my children to know a faith that is sturdy, right? That that can handle their doubts and their questions and their concerns. And I want to do my part now to help cast vision for that for them, to help them actually meet God in these difficult experiences that they do have, so that as they grow, so that as those challenges become a bit unwieldy I'm not there, that they have already practiced meeting God in those difficult places. So, Ahiwani, I'm interested to hear from you. How has your faith helped you cope with hard things? If I can ask you a little bit of a personal question.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I think it's hard to pick one example, but to just pick generally in terms of people go through betrayal, disappointments, and even loss of friendships, loss of loved ones, and all of that. And for me, God is the constant person who is always there to comfort. Again, it may come as cliche to just say God is the one who comforts. And sometimes you have to truly deal with the pain of the betrayal, the pain of the hardship that you go through. But even in the midst of that, even in those painful situations, God assures me of his presence, assures me of his never-changing quality of loving, caring father that he is. And so for me, it's just that reassurance that I often get from the Lord saying, yes, you may be going through this tough situation. It may be difficult for you to understand. Yes, you are hurting, but just know that my counsel, my wisdom, my care is always for you. And one verse that, and sometimes when I cite this verse or when people cite this verse, sometimes we do it for different reasons. Romans 8:28, and God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him and are called according to his purposes. Now, there's a broader understanding of what that verse would mean, even in the context of our salvation in Christ. But even in the mundane things that happen in our lives, even the day-to-day things, I can look back at things I cried about, I was worried about. But then within God's economy, God's larger scope of things, I can begin to see where they fit in. And sometimes we may not even see clearly, but His purposes are very true. So that's kind of like where my reflections would go.
Well, I'm so glad that we have Dr. Holly Allen here with us to share her wisdom.
Yes.
Dr. Allen recently retired from her position as professor of Christian Ministries and Family Science at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. I first encountered Dr. Allen at the Children's Spirituality Summit in 2018. I think I was kind of attending there as like a children's ministry leader who was kind of having these ideas and reading these books and thinking, am I the only person who's asking these questions? And no. I wasn't. And she was just such a generous and hospitable person and voice. And so I'm so glad to have her here.
Yep. And in fact, she has authored several books, including Forming Resilient Children, The Role of Spiritual Formation for Healthy Development. So welcome, Dr. Holly Allen.
Thank you. It's delightful to be with you today.
Yes, thank you for joining us. I think it's important for us to define, what does resilient mean? Why is it such a popular word right now?
Generally, and there are all kinds of fancy definitions, but the way I understand it and the way it seems to connect with people easiest is to say, well, a child or a person is resilient when they exhibit generally positive developmental outcomes, like getting along with others, listening to adults, listening to your parents, doing well enough in school, following society's rules, and of course, avoiding things like aggression, violence, mental disorders such as depression, anxiety, social withdrawal. When you see those kinds of things in a child, then you begin to suspect something is wrong. So when we mean resilience, in light of adversity, they're able to come through in a way that shows them still getting along with people, doing well enough in school, still listening to adults, and avoiding some of those other things. Not going down a rabbit hole of depression or anxiety, being overly anxious about everything. You're not exhibiting resilience when wrapped up in what's wrong, and that's all you can think about.
So how do children develop resilience? What's kind of the bird's eye view overview of what goes into that process?
We found out in the pandemic that many children hadn't really faced a lot of hardships. Many had, but many hadn't. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know if you're going to be resilient if you've not hit any walls yet. So we began to find out that a lot of kids who had good enough schools, good enough parents, they'd had good enough health, this was their first big wall to hit. And we found out that many children, in fact, were resilient and many children were not. Mm-hmm. I think calling small things like not getting invited to a party or the balloon that popped, handling it as though it's one of those little small little walls that you hit instead of dismissing it. Mm-hmm. Oh, I know that was hard listening. So if we're talking to parents, listening to your child when they fall down and hurt their knee, oh, that hurts. Oh, I'm sorry. Not dismissing it, allowing them to express their feelings, but not dwelling forever in it. You know, like, oh, I know last week you fell down and hurt your knee. How are you today? You know, making a really huge deal out of it is not helpful either. I know, we'll get you about 10 more balloons. Your balloon popped. We'll get you 10 more. Not overblowing it, but accepting it for the small disappointment that it is, not dismissing it. Accepting their reality, which is, I miss my balloon. I wanted my balloon. I wanted to go to that party. Accepting that their heart is hurt. Naming that with them, helping them come up with words for their feelings. Like, so you're frustrated? That's a good word for kids. They're sad. They're frustrated. They're upset. Yeah, I understand that. And then helping them move on in those small things. Not parking too long, but not dismissing. I think that's the beginning. You don't want to wait until the huge thing happens to say, now we need to start thinking about resilience. So I think paying attention to the small things and treating them as what they are, small disappointments, small losses, but they are that.
Yes.
And the generation before me, I think, tended to say, get over it. Just get over it. So you hurt your knee, you're okay. So you popped your balloon, it's just a balloon. And so you begin to shut down the feelings that you are legitimately feeling and you think they don't count. And then when something much bigger comes along, you still think your feelings don't count. And you don't know how to cope with it, dwell with it. The other main thing I would say to parents is you need to exhibit resilience. The small things and certainly in the larger things. If you get a ticket for speeding, call it what it is. I was speeding. I'm going to have to pay my ticket. I'm upset with myself. I'm upset that I wasn't paying attention. And then say, I accept the consequences. Instead of saying, this is ridiculous. I can't believe he was there. And getting all upset, blowing it out of proportion, or saying something like, oh, well, it's really nothing.
Yeah,
it is something. Calling it what it is. Managing your own disappointment with yourself and maybe frustrations you feel with whatever else was going on, but exhibiting that for your children. They get to see you manage a relatively small thing. And when the bigger things come along, again, seeing you handle them appropriately. Mm.
The example that immediately came to my mind is that I can have this tendency, right, when my child has a small adversity, like, you know, the popped balloon, the sister who gets to do something that I don't get to do, you know, is that then it's my own resilience that kind of sets the tone for how that whole thing goes, right? Because if I go, oh my gosh, my child's not resilient at all, that can really derail things versus like you're talking about, this is a small frustration. Of course, my child's going to exhibit, you know, some kind of reaction to that. I can be present to this child that's here right now and help them deal with this small thing and also be present to myself. Ooh, I'm feeling a little nervous about this. And I need to kind of rest and trust that, like, as I help my child learn to deal with these small disappointments that maybe, you know, that those things actually do matter in developing resilience. I don't, for me as a parent, it's really comforting to hear you say, that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's helpful, Lindsay, because sometimes even our rebuke or our, when we try to quieten the, what seems big to kids and we think it's a small thing, it's our lack of allowing resilience to grow in us. It's like, no, I don't want to be frustrated dealing with this. So just zip it, keep quiet, and let's move on. And so it is in helping them that we also develop our resilience. So, yeah.
Good point. It's a good point.
Yeah. And as I think of it, Dr. Allen, the place of spirituality, what role does it play in helping kids experience this adversity and resilience that we're talking about?
Well, I was not explicitly aware of that connection until I began reading all this literature. The book that was probably the best one for me is by Ann Mastin, and it's Ordinary Magic. What she's saying, it's not like some giant thing that happens to your child to help them be resilient. It's the small things. She comes up with 10. And the first one is, of course, capable parenting. And what that means in what the way she defines it is parents who listen, who encourage, who listen to a child's fears and hopes, who encourage the child. And especially when you get into the harder things, a parent who carries the burden of hard things. So parents who carry the burden for themselves and for their children when something really hard happens. But along the way, even in these hard things, but in the smaller things, they listen to a child's fears and hopes. And they encourage them. Other relationships are contributing factors to resilience. Other adults, grandparents, aunts, uncles, even peers, and even a boyfriend or girlfriend, if it's a teenager, can be important in that resilience journey. Self qualities. We sometimes feel like some children just actually are born, you know, like advocating for themselves, like, I'm in this world and I will take care of it. I have one kid like that. And then I have another kid who came into the world going, can I just go back in? You know, just like, I really want to do this. And so you don't just say, well, that's who they are. We're not going to do anything about it. All these relationships and all the things that we do in a child's life can help promote self-efficacy, agency, becoming more self-motivated. But those kind of self-qualities really can contribute to resilience. Kids who are more self-regulated, emotionally regulated, tend to be more resilient. So some of these qualities we can't exactly fix, but we can encourage. And then another quality, which is, I just hadn't put this all together, that spiritual quality. Her 10th protective factor, she calls faith, the understanding that life has meaning, She doesn't actually call it spirituality. Hope is another factor she puts in, but all the literature names it different things. Some will just call it spirituality or religiosity. She says faith, the idea that life has meaning, and hope. Others say, you know, just having a prayer life, belief in God. Those pieces of the resilience puzzle, those can make a huge difference in the life of a child. And I looked back after I began reading all this literature, and I began to see that in my own life, there had been times that I didn't have words for, but I could look back and see that God was present. It would have been wonderfully helpful had my heritage been able to help me name those times then. I spent a lot of time alone back in our creek behind our house, needing some peace. And I look back now and know God was there. But no one actually said God was there with you. And we can do that for and with our children, that God is present in those dark, hard times. He is here. He's among us. And with kids that are older who are just coming to understand this, we can say, you know, that time you told me about, that time when that boy knocked you down, I want you to remember that moment. And I want you to look back on the playground and look around and see if Jesus is there. And so when you're 17 or 19 or 37 or 52, you can go back and in your mind's eye and see where God was present. So these kinds of things, the spiritual piece, can heal and it can also provide resilience early on if we are already aware that God is among us. He is with us. He is here. He hurts with you. He knows you. He feels with you. I teach the fifth grade class, and 2 weeks ago, one of the boys in our class had a sledding accident. I mean, he's in critical condition. He is beginning to recover, and he's starting to eat now a little bit. He has his personality still there saying, no, I don't want that. Yes, I do. No, that's good. But we prayed Sunday over him, and we talked about, was God there? He doesn't necessarily prevent everything, but that doesn't mean he wasn't there. And that was important for these children who know this boy to say he was there. And when you go see him, imagine Jesus in that empty chair, in that room with him. So in the present, naming what children experience and then naming the fact that God is present, he is with us, that he knows, all that is intertwined. Now, I didn't get very much of that as a child. I was raised in a Christian home, but we didn't name things like that. So I didn't know, but it has been a great comfort to me to look back now and say, indeed, I was there. I saw you. I knew. And that has comforted my heart even now.
What helps you get through hard things?
I talk to my parents about it and the people that I trust.
Sometimes I ask myself, what does it feel like? If I can imagine what it feels like, then it hurts. But if like I can't really place the feeling, it kind of like goes away. It's like weird, but like it helps.
I had another friend who had the same problem with the same person. So I started hanging out with them and we talked about it. And so it was better when I had another person to talk to about it instead of just dealing with myself.
Help us to imagine what this can look like, naming this for children in our lives in the midst of our kind of daily life. What can this look like?
I would say in the small things, name what you're feeling. I know we're frustrated. I know we're running late. But I'm calling on Jesus right now to calm my spirit. I mean, it's not a life and death situation. You're just running late. Traffic's terrible. But I'm calling on Jesus now to calm my spirit so that I don't become anxious. And you can tell your children, this is what I'm doing. I'm calling on Jesus now to comfort my heart. Listening well to your children. What are you feeling? Helping name their feelings. Assure them of your presence, that you will be with them. Assuring them of God's presence. Modeling for your children how to call on help. We were going through kind of a meltdown period in our church, and so our family was being deeply affected by that. And one of my children called one of my friends and said, could you come over? And she did. So, you know, to model that and to say, and we had done this before, you know, could you come? We're having a discussion. Could you help us with this? And so she did that, didn't even tell me. And here came my friend. I was like, hi. And she just said, well, Bethany called. So modeling those kinds of things. Really important ways. Where did you see God today? When you're reading any story at all to your children, you can ask, who are you in the story? My definition of children's spirituality is their relationship with self, others, and God. And all those are wrapped up in that spiritual piece, because we know God said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Those are all relationships that we're to live into healthily. So ask who you are in the story and then say, why are you that person? That will reveal their hearts to you. And they might eventually say, who are you in the story? And then you can say, I'm this person. And they'll say, oh, I don't think you're that person. Or, yeah, you are. So you can have those really rich, lovely little conversations about I am and who you are. These are really quite easy things to do with children. You don't have to sit down and just say, we're going to have a 20-minute devotional now.
Right.
You can just assume that God is at work, and how do we see him do that?
Yeah. It takes practice. It takes time for resilience to be developed. It's not something you wake up and you're like, yep, I'm resilient. And so even in your experience, Holly, you would say you look back in some of those experiences early on in your life, and you didn't have a naming for them. People didn't have those conversations with you. Right. But you look back and you see, oh, God was there. What do you think is at stake if we don't have those conversations? Again, yes, we know it ultimately it doesn't build the resilience, but what else would be at stake? What do we miss? What consequences are there on the person if we don't have avenues to process those experiences, to have a naming for them, to grow in that resilience?
If we avoid the spiritual pieces, because our world does essentially say, these are the things you need to do to make your child resilient. They avoid all the spiritual pieces. Yeah. Although they have sometimes the child self relationship going and the child others piece, but they tend to avoid the child God. If we avoid that, then the child won't be looking to God for those answers, for that support, for that healing, for that hope. I had a good theology. I had a good belief system, but I didn't have that relational language that he was present, that he was here. So I would say they will bifurcate their lives into how do I psychologically deal with the stuff that's happening in my life so that I can manage my life better. And then I'll go to church and I'll worship on Sunday.
Yeah.
And I think we're just full of people. The whole Christian world has a lot of folks who've bifurcated their world. They don't bring their belief system into anything else they do, and it appropriately fits on Sunday. And they don't know how. They don't know how. I don't think they don't believe it. They just, it's not done. Yeah. And children learn very, very early that spiritual conversations are just really not very acceptable. And all the literature that I read will say, oh, as young as six, they begin picking up on that. Oh, Jesus was there. And everybody, there's a big silence. The teacher doesn't say, you want to tell us more about that? New. So they pick up early on what not to say and how not to call things. We as parents and our churches need to be those voices that say, this is who we are and how we see all of life. But that bifurcation does not serve us well in our whole lives.
I think one of the beautiful things about these opportunities is that children, it's a little easier for them, and that we can take these opportunities. And so I noticed in your book, you have a whole chapter on the place of wonder in developing resilience. And anybody who has like a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old knows, or has ever spent time with a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old, knows that this is like something children are naturally very attuned to. It's a strength of them to wonder about things, to wonder at things. How can we foster and nurture that wonder? I think it's even related to what you're talking about with children kind of learn that that's not really a way people exist in the world, you know, past a certain age. So how can we help to foster and nurture that rather than squelching it?
I have taught Sunday school most of my life. Just this past Sunday, yesterday, we were studying the five feeding of the 5,000. Well, in that same chapter, it said, and John the Baptist was killed. And so one of the questions I ask, why do you think God allowed John the Baptist to be killed? Now, that's a fifth grader. You wouldn't ask this maybe of a 3-year-old. I have 30-something in that class that they weren't all there yesterday, but that's how many. They're raised in Christian homes. they've not experienced many opportunities to respond to open-ended questions. Mm-hmm. They do really well with how many lepers were there, yes. How many did Jesus heal, how many came back and said thank you, but they feel a little iffy, like they're looking in the Bible, and of course it doesn't say. So I've spent, with these fifth graders, I've spent, you know, some months now asking open-ended, wondering questions. How would you have felt if you were the woman with the issue of blood and you wanted to touch Jesus, but you didn't know if you could or not? How would you have felt? How did she get the courage to do that? Why do you think God included this story in the Bible? Mm. I mean, we don't know. I mean, we don't get an answer to that anywhere, but they're becoming more comfortable now responding. And I'm not going to laugh, and I don't, you know, if it's an amusing answer, we'd say, well, yeah, you know, it might be that. And just go with it. But it has opened their minds. And the Bible has felt, I think, like a book of questions and answers that we're just supposed to get right. And it's expanding the book of God is actually Him. It's like, I'm telling you who I am. I'm not telling you words. I'm telling you who I am. So it's bigger than just the words. Who is God in this story? What is He doing? The most important question I ask, what is God doing? I wonder what He's doing in this story. He's healing people. Why? You know, why did Jesus do miracles? Because He could? I mean, you know, they don't know yet. So we're living into a much bigger version of what's going on. With younger children, you ask less intense questions.
Yeah.
But just the wonder questions are delightful. It also tells them they can ask wonder questions.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder, Miss Holly, I wonder if Mary had said no to the angel, what would have happened? Isn't that a great question? You know, you can always turn it around and go, I don't know, what do you think?
Thank you, Holly. I love those examples, especially because I think we can think, you know, wondering question can feel very Mr. Rogers, which I love Mr. Rogers. And that's, but Mr. Rogers talked about hard things too. And I love that there's that wondering isn't only this kind of like, magical, you know, but it is something children do very naturally. And so taking them seriously, honoring that and responding with honesty and with, just like you said, that confidence in the Lord and in the Lord's presence. I think sometimes we think it's this complicated thing, and it just has a lot to do with presence and with honoring the child as a real person who's being very honest and and being, you know, appropriately honest back to them.
And those questions, I mean, asking questions, open-ended questions, it invites the conversation to tilt toward that space of wonder. But when we ask questions like that, we must be ready to listen as well too, right? And I like what you said about learning to listen, but also modeling how to ask those questions, those open-ended questions. So at the church, at home, all of that is very critical. And so I know you have mentioned some of those in the course of the conversation, but what are some concrete ways that parents, in addition to asking these questions, to modeling resilience, to listening to the children, how can they help their children just to foster this resilience, even in their spiritual development?
Well, those are very intertwined.
Yeah.
Anything that a parent does that nurtures the child's relationship with self, parent does that nurtures their relationship with friends. I mean, we don't think of having a little play date as a spiritual exercise, but it is. You're nurturing their relationship with others.
Yeah.
I've had parents... when I was raising our kids, who were very hands-off. They would say, oh, send the kids down to the basement. They'll be fine. And they're like four. And I'm going, that feels a little hands-off to me. And then, of course, there were parents who would never let their children out of their sight. And that's, you know, the other flip side of that. But monitoring what's going on in those play dates so that you can intervene. Fours and fives aren't very good at getting along, Mm-hmm. They imagine things they cannot do and they think they can. Somebody takes over and is the boss and everybody else has to follow. So monitoring, helping model for them what it looks like to be a friend, to be kind, mm-hmm. to be helpful. I believe it is the most important thing for parents to help children name their experiences with God. I remember being 11 and being that pre-adolescent yuck, you know, I threw myself on the bed, nobody loves me, blah, blah, blah. And I just was terrible, you know, having a terrible meltdown to myself. I was alone in my bedroom. And then there was this really quiet moment. And I had no language for it at the time, but God saying, I was present. I'm the one who spoke to you and said, you are my beloved daughter in whom I'm well pleased. I didn't have language. Had I known it and been able to speak it to my parents, they probably would have gotten, you know, psychological help or something for me, because that was not a possibility in my world. But having language to say, who is God? Who is he in your life? What is he doing? Naming the things that God does now, not just what did he do with Job, or what did he do with Jonah, or what did he do with Abraham, not what did he do with Judas or Mary. Those are important. What is he doing now? I mean, yesterday in our class, we prayed for this little boy who's in the hospital. And one of the children said, miraculously heal him. And I thought, amen, amen. And another one said, we want him back just like he was. And I love that too. And then later, you know, the conversation did go, what if he doesn't completely heal? And said, what if he doesn't? Will we still love him? Yeah. Will he still be Colson? Yeah. And we talked through those things to say, what if hard things happen and they don't resolve exactly the way we want? How do we go forward? And we begin to address that. What can we do now? We signed a card and all that. What is God doing now? What is God doing now? And one of the children said, I think he's knitting all those little brain things back in, because it's the brain that was the most affected. He's bringing all those little brain things back together so that they work right. Because the early reports we had was, you know, that he wasn't responding appropriately. And we were afraid, you know, the brain was going to be all scrambled. And so that's what God is doing now. He's putting some of those little brain things back together. And somebody said they're molecules. And somebody else said, no, I don't think that's what it is. And cells. And they kind of argued over that. We were literally talking about, what is God doing now? I think the way I have said it and I feel most strongly about is that children who know a God who is present, who understands what they have experienced, who offers them unconditional love, who is at work bringing about justice in their situation, who's orchestrating healing, restoration, and recovery, loves them. These children possess the most powerful resilience armor there is.
Well, and I think of the local church, which those principles you've shared for the home, we can apply that in the local church. But what might that look like for the community of faith, building resilience? What's the role of the church? Or how might the church go about doing that, even as we think of all of the generations represented in the local church?
Children need to see that somebody besides their parents believes all these things. Identity is one of those enormous things. And we think, oh, that's a teenage thing. Yes, it is. But our identity is formed all along. And you lean into the identity you've been forming as a teenager, and you start having opportunities to act out of that in situations where your parents aren't there. When you are in a body of believers who are saying some of the same things, and they say, this is what happened. This is who I am. This is who God is. And you hear that story. And then you hear another story. It's not just your parents telling you this. This is a body of people who belong to God. That that sense of belonging is one of the huge words in the resilience literature. Sense of belonging. And you do need to feel like you belong in your family, but that there's a larger group of people who surround you. If your parents, even if they're believing people, don't know how to do some of these other things, you can be with others who ask you, how are you feeling? That was hard, wasn't it? The divorce literature, I've read quite a bit of that, and they said that a lot of times when parents divorce, nobody asks them about it. No one says, how are you doing? We just don't know how to handle it, the other adults. Now, we need to. We need to step in there and say, I know this is hard. One of the best things that happens with my children that we work with and my mentors that work with them is when one of my student mentors has come from a family that was divorced, and the child sees that, and they see this 19-year-old going to college, managing life well, and they begin to believe that can happen with me also. So you hear stories across a wider spectrum. You see God's work across a wider spectrum. You belong to a large group of people who love you, know your name, call you into that same identity. This is kind of a little broader scale, but it's the next logical one. Our world starts pretty small with our family. Yeah. It needs to expand and to reach into larger places. Those Sunday school teachers can do things that parents can't do. They can broaden the discussion. So I had one teacher who told, when she taught me in sixth grade, she told stories of her own doubts. I didn't know that was, you know, you could do that. Nobody talked about their doubts. But she was a believing, strong Christian, but she said, I've had times. That was important for her to model that for me. I could see, so that when I was 30 or 50 and started having doubts, like, oh, it's over for me. I'm done now. I remembered her sharing those doubts and yet coming through that. So you get to hear all the stories that your parents can't tell you because it didn't happen to them. So that, and how can we do that? I think intergenerational small groups are some of the best ways to do that. So that's what I'll recommend. I'll just leave on that little teasing note. I'm writing some intergenerational curriculum for small groups. And it's something I've been wanting to do for 30 years. And that's one of the things I'm doing in retirement. So the interest is there. And I think it will be ready to be published before long. So,
Holly, I'm so excited. I have read, so I will also tease your book. If you want to know more about them while you're waiting for the curriculum, you can read, was it Intergenerational Christian Formation? Is that what it's called? Right? And, also in the resilience book, you tell some beautiful stories from intergenerational small groups as well. This is like one of my favorite things that you talk about. So I'm so excited to hear that there's a curriculum.
We're doing it right now in our congregation. And so I'm getting stories from as we're doing these small groups and they're using the curriculum. I'm getting feedback. Leave that icebreaker out. That did not work. So it's been really fun to get to do this. I've been wanting to for a long time. So that's one of the things I'm doing in retirement. It's delightful.
Oh, this is awesome. This is awesome.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. We cannot thank you enough for sparing your time to share your experience, personal experience, but also insights from practice and research. If you don't mind, if you can say a prayer, pray for families, pray for the church around this topic that we've talked about.
God Almighty, the one who knows us and sees us, the one who goes before us, the great I Am. We honor you. We recognize that you are over all, and yet you have chosen to come close. And we thank you for that. You have been watching us for these hundreds and thousands of years, calling our name, drawing us close. And we once again thank you for that and ask you to continue doing so. We all know families where your name is rarely spoken, even though they come to church. We ask that we and others will model before them ways that they can begin to tiptoe into an area they feel uncomfortable with, that they can call your name, that they will come to know your very presence in their lives, and their children will see this as well. Thank you for leaders who are calling churches further up and further into your work. They're leading in ways that we are learning to call you by name, all the ways that you've been with us and the ways that you are present with us now. We ask that the parents who are asking you, that you will open their eyes to the resources around them to help them listen better to their children, comfort and encourage, and also be the parent that carries the weight when it's necessary. We are still growing. One of the hard things about being a parent, we know, is that we're not there yet. And so we ask you to prompt us, to remind us that you are filling in the gaps that we leave. If we overlook something, you don't just leave us splashing about, wondering if we're going to drown. You will fill in those gaps and continue to fill in the gaps in our own hearts as we recover from hard things in our past when we didn't have the tools that we needed. Bless us, uphold us, sustain us as we parent, even our adult children, and as we teach the children that you've placed in our care, and as we intermingle with all the children around us, and the young adults, and the middle adults, and the older adults, that we may continue to grow with them toward you. I bless this new ministry that has come to fruition through Mimi Larson's work and her petition for the Lilly Grant, and for this podcast, Child in the Midst. That you will bless Lindsay and Ahuami as they interview people, that the words that are spoken, the questions that are asked, will prompt exactly the response that people who are listening will need. Mm-hmm. We trust you. We lean into you. We've learned that we cannot do it on our own, and mm-hmm. trusting you is a much better choice. And so we do. We rest in you to cover the spaces and the holes that we leave behind. We pray this through Jesus' name.
Have you ever talked to God about something hard?
Sometimes when like I'm overwhelmed or stuff, I just go up in my bed and like stuff my face in the pillow and like praying in my head. I can just let all my feelings out and like no one's watching me and no one's judging me. He's always there for me and like I can sometimes like feel the warmth of him and like feel him with me.
I asked Jesus for help and then a few days later, me and my friend stopped fighting and we became friends again.
Thanks for joining us for The Child in Our Midst. We encourage you to pause for a moment of reflection and identify your one action step or takeaway from this episode. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we hope you'll share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave us a rating and review. The Child in Our Midst is a podcast of the Center for Faith and Children at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. It's produced by Area Code Audio.
Do you feel like God was with you during that hard thing? It's okay if the answer is not really or you don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah.